Welcome to Nonviolent Direct Action, where we examine the societal and personal ramifications of Dr. Martin Luther King's insight that to passively accept an unjust system is to cooperate with that system and thereby to become a participant in its evil. I'm Jack Gilroy, host of episode 2 of this series. Today I'll be speaking with well-known peace activist Kathy Kelly, who has participated in numerous nonviolent direct actions, thereby serving multiple prison sentences, and who has practiced war tax resistance since 1982. She's the co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Welcome, Kathy, and it's such an honor to speak with you. It's not often that the general public has an opportunity to learn what makes nonviolent people tick. And that's what this program is all about today. We want to find out what it was in your stories, your history, that led you to situations where you put yourself on the line. And we just would very much like to let people around the world know that, yes, this is the Kathy Kelly who has received 2 nominations for the Nobel Peace Prize. What is it, Kathy, that you think that, first of all, before we get into your childhood, et cetera, what is it that you think makes you and some others take this kind of action to stand up and resist illegal, immoral, unjust laws?
Well, first of all, thank you, Jack, for inviting me into this conversation. And, I think that there was a time I was in Australia, and it wasn't that long ago, maybe 8 years ago. Somebody who has been one of my mentors was in a room when I was asked that question, and I started to talk to Neville Watson and the others about experiences in my childhood that I thought might have made a difference. And he said, well, I reckon you've got it all wrong. He said, I've known you for a long time. And what happens with you is you just fall in love with people easily. And I think I must have blushed and I didn't quite know what to say. But in a way, Neville had it right. I've been so fortunate, so lucky in my life to have encountered regularly some of the finest people in the world who have drawn me into situations that I don't regret, that are often very, very challenging. I don't at all want to say that, we always find the right solution. But I have been always persuaded since, I guess, I was in my late 20s that this effort to abolish war, to put an end to the constant, ugly, horrific war-making that has so characterized and scarred our planet and the lives of numerous people, this is an important effort, and I never feel like it's waning in importance, and I always feel grateful to have met the people I've met whose commitment has always edified me and drawn me in further.
Can we dig a little deeper, and could you, for example, tell us a little bit about your childhood, where you grew up, where you lived, and maybe then we can get on to some of the schooling that that had some impact on you. Can you start from the beginning?
Well, my beginning was in an area of the southwest side of Chicago, which was in some ways, a very, very safe place in which to grow up. I mean, as kids, we all thought mom, dad, the parish priests and nuns, officer friendly, our teachers, everybody was in it together to make sure that we were happy and secure, and we basically were. And we barely knew that problems existed. We also didn't realize that we were growing up in one of the most racist neighborhoods in the United States. It was certainly that. And
what about you as a child? Do you remember any racist situations that when you say that, but did you observe firsthand that kind of thing? And did it have any impact on you at that time?
Well, I should qualify a little bit. As a child, I also was very fortunate to be raised and taught by some very fine people. And I want to mention that the nuns that taught us never had any demonstrable interest. They never showed the slightest interest in acquiring personal wealth. And that's been very important to me. I should also say that my mother was born into dire poverty in Ireland. Her family was so desperate that they had to send her off as an indentured servant. And that's how she spent her teen years until she was in her very young 20s and she met my father, married him overseas, and then they came to Chicago. And I don't believe that my mother carried with her the racist antagonism that was very much a part of this neighborhood where I grew up. People were afraid. They were afraid that the neighborhood would, as they would say back then, turn, that a black family might move into the neighborhood and people's property values would go down. It was that crass. And I didn't understand any of that until when I went to high school. It became very, very evident that people hated the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. He was stoned. People threw stones at him in my neighborhood. And it became very apparent that...
When you say threw stones, you're verbal stones.
No, a physical stone hit him in the head and the blood trickled down the side of his head.
Right there in Chicago?
On the southwest side of Chicago as he pursued an open housing march. And actually, Dr. King regarded that campaign as one of the ones where they just simply had to wrap it up and give up. It was such a hostile environment for him to try to unite people in an open housing struggle.
You know, I don't want to sidetrack you too much on this, but this is really interesting. This sort of thing, do you think that there was something about your neighborhood? Was it mainly Irish? Was it Irish Catholic? Or was it a mixed ethnic group of other nationalities?
Well, we barely knew that anyone existed that wasn't Catholic. So it certainly was a very Catholic environment. And then beyond that, it was mostly new immigrant families, maybe second generation, first generation, many ethnic backgrounds. And I think many people who, although I have to be clear, I never really thought about this much until more recently, but I think a lot of the people who were first or second generation Irish, Italian, German, Polish, Slavic, some French, I think many were traumatized by World War I and World War II, or were the children, the descendants of people who were traumatized. And we sometimes lose sight of that. You know, the wars end, and particularly after World War II, people like my dad got the GI Bill. That's the only reason he could even dream of purchasing a house. But there were traumas that were residual that maybe people didn't talk about very much.
Do you think these were deep racial traumas because of the color of the skin, or did you also have some sort of an economic threat of black workers in Chicago?
Well, sure, there was an economic threat, but I think there's also a deep racism. I think there was an automatic sense that somehow white people were better than black people. And there's no way to explain it other than to call it for what it is, racism. And I, you know, don't think that it would be a stretch to say that apartheid was and still is being practiced in Chicago. The South Side of Chicago is still representative of apartheid practices. And if you were to go back to that neighborhood where I grew up, you might find some Muslim families moving in, some Hispanic families, but I can almost guarantee you a black family won't move in across a certain dividing line. It happens to be called Western Avenue. And the tragedy, the terrible tragedy of violent deaths by gun violence in certain neighborhoods of Chicago is exacerbated because the all-black neighborhoods have been consistently neglected, never benefited from a sense on the part of the city of Chicago that there should be investment in the neighborhoods and a creation of jobs in the neighborhoods and an improvement of the schooling in the neighborhoods. Instead, people have experienced the collateral consequences of mass incarceration, specifically in the black neighborhoods in Chicago.
Well, here you have Obama as president of the United States and a Chicago guy, and he was not able to really bring about massive assistance and programs, education and work that you mentioned. So, you know, what can we expect today? Yeah, what's the vision and what's the hope for the people of South Chicago?
Well, I think it's always important to be respectful and to treat other people as human beings, but also to be as honest as we can in telling the truth to power and about power. And President Obama was a centrist and a militarist, in my belief.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that he was somebody who said that in his presidency he would level with the U.S. public about the military-industrial complex. Actually, Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican, in the last days of his presidency, leveled more so than almost any other president, I think, when he said very clearly, beware the unwarranted influence of the military-industrial complex. And I think President Obama could have said, it might have cost him a second term, but he could have said, look, I am under the control of this military-industrial complex. There are things that I believe ought to be done, and many of my constituents believe ought to be done. But as I try to pursue challenging, for instance, the bloated military budget, or refusing to go along with the wrongful sentencing policies, saying that Israel should no longer be allowed to hold on to 200 to 400 thermonuclear weapons and wage conventional warfare against people trapped in Gaza. If he were to say, look, I know these policies that the U.S. is practicing are wrongful, and I'm under the vice-like grip of the military-industrial congressional media complex, he could have leveled with the U.S. public and said that. But instead, he constantly made room for more drone attacks, for more deportations, for continuance of mass incarceration policies. And although he's somebody whom, again, I want to say is deserving of respect and appreciation as a fellow human being, a very attractive personality, someone who set up such a good example in so many ways in terms of how he treated other people in his presidency, he nevertheless cooperated with the military and the I think the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King expressed it so well, the demonic suction cup of military spending.
Now, Kathy, if we can jump back to your childhood, as you move out of the childhood stage into high school and in college, where did you go to college or university?
I went to Loyola University. That's located on the north side of Chicago, and that geographic change meant a great deal to me. I began to revel in the diversity that was much more accessible. Certainly not enough.
What was going on around that time? Were there issues in protests and activities that you observed? And what were your thoughts or actions at that time?
Well, you know, 50 years ago, Chicago in 1968 was the scene of the Democratic National Convention. And one thing was very, very, very clear at that time. People wanted to end the war in Vietnam. It took more years, but when you heard chants eventually that said, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? It was not only an outrage over people coming back in body bags, you know, young people that many of us in my neighborhood had gone to school with. It wasn't only outrage over the draft, But it was also outrage over scorched earth policies, outrage about massacres like the My Lai massacre, outrage over children being napalmed. There was definite outrage about that war, and people wanted it to end. And I think so importantly, you simply would not have heard anyone say, gee, let's start another war like the Vietnam War. Let's do that again.
So when all this was taking, when I remember well the bloodshed in the streets, it was national television and living and dying color, you know, of what was going on. But where were you? Were you at Loyola in 1968? And did Loyola students, where were their sentiments? Where were your sentiments toward Kennedy and, you know, and McCarthy and LBJ and all the rest at that time, Richard Nixon?
Well, Jack, I don't want to make excuses for myself. I was a late bloomer and quite fear-bound when I was in my college years. I was also working 40 hours a week and, you know, had quite a bit to keep myself busy. But I never lifted a finger to pass out a flyer, to call an elected representative, to go to a meeting. I did write my papers. In fact, I wrote papers about the Vietnam War, which makes it even more inexcusable that I never found my way to any action. And I knew enough to cry over the New York Times. I wept. And I prayed. I went to Mass just about every day. I longed and I prayed. And I started to begin to understand the Berrigans. And that was by virtue of going to a tiny little bookstore that was tucked into a loft area almost in downtown Chicago. And if I got to my part-time job early enough, I could spend 15 minutes inside the bookstore, St. Benet's bookstore. And that started me on a path of great curiosity and an increasing sense of how wrongful it was that some people were starving, some people were treated as second-class citizens or as people with no right to live, while other people didn't have to ask any questions about how much they consumed.
Do you think some of those stories from your mother and father dating from an early age, they must have told you some of the injustices in Ireland? Do you think maybe some of this was helped trigger your feelings about what was going on in the United States and in Vietnam?
Well, I was very curious about my parents having been in London during the Blitz of London, and I was curious about my mother having grown up in terrible poverty. And I think it sort of gave me a sort of a natural sense of socialism. I couldn't have called it that, but the sense that there shouldn't be haves and have-nots, and there should be a distribution of goods that was much more fair. But truthfully, what woke me up in terms of at least the beginnings of not wanting to always be a spectator or an observer or someone who sits on the sidelines was the film Night and Fog. And that was shown to me in high school, and it created the grooves, if you will, kind of like an old long-playing record. It created the emotional grooves for me to deeply long to be part of something that would resist the horrible wrongfulness of the Holocaust. When I began to see through novels like André Schwarzbart's The Last of the Just or Bernard Malamud, Elie Wiesel's very powerful writing in Night, and that's the name of a novel, one of his first novels, I began to sense that I didn't want to be sitting on the sidelines. So that's what awakened consciousness.
How old were you then, Kathy?
Well, I was in high school then, but that, as I say, it took me a very, very long time before I finally reached a point where I did get off of the bleachers and start to get involved. And that involved going to a soup kitchen on Chicago's North Side and being very, very shaky, thinking, oh, what am I doing? And as soon as I got into the basement of St. Thomas Parish Church and started chopping onions and putting together the soup ingredients with some very interesting and welcoming people, I felt a sigh of relief. I thought, I've finally arrived where I belong. And I moved up to that neighborhood about 3 months later. And I have to say, it's where I still live. The grass never looks greener to me.
And maybe I'm jumping ahead. Was it around that time that the Catholic Worker began to come into your mind? Or when was that you began to consider spending some time with the Catholic Worker?
Well, I very fondly called the neighborhood the Do-Gooders Ghetto. In the neighborhood called Uptown, lived right alongside people who never had enough to eat, who often, even in the cold winter, didn't have a warm or a comfortable place to stay. The homelessness was extreme and consistent. There were children that came to the soup kitchen for their meals with their parents. You had to set up little high chairs for them to eat on. There were veterans of wars who had been crazed by their experiences in war, and World War II vets, Korean vets, Vietnam vets. And we had in the neighborhood teenagers who often couldn't survive their teenage years. The gang violence was so strong. There was a lot of chaos. But at the same time, there were people who simply said, well, we're going to roll up our sleeves and try to do what we can to make things better for people and do it in the most humane way we can find to do it, and made plenty of mistakes. But I was myself in awe of how much good could be accomplished through the soup kitchen, the shelter, the Catholic Worker House, the drop-in center for elderly women, the pencil pushers store where a lot of the street kids could try to sell pencils and papers and books instead of drugs, the kindness that people strove for, and the ways in which people embraced one another. And because it was such a poor neighborhood, it was the port of entry for new immigrants. And so with all of the neediness that was represented in the neighborhood, you also had people coming in from Eritrea, from Ethiopia, and then eventually, increasingly, not only from Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos, but also Central America and the Native American Indian population, the Black population. It was quite a mixture.
I'm trying to put some of these years together as you speak. And I'm thinking now, you're in high school when the Chicago Convention took place, but now by 1972 or so, you're at Loyola.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And there were major things happening at that time as well. In 1971, of course, that the tremendous direct action down in Washington, D.C., where many of the anti-war people said they were just going to stop the government. If the government won't stop the war, they're going to stop the government. Remember that? They lied down in the streets. They blocked off, places. And Mary McGrew of the Washington Post said it was the most disorganized, and she was anti-war. She was really down on it. But later, the FBI and some of the leading Magruder, I think, said that it was a turning point for Nixon, knowing that he had to do something major had to take place to end the war. But all that time now, you're at Loyola, and can you tell us anything there about what your sense was of what was going on? Did the Berrigans have any effect on Loyola? Did you see any sort of change that Dan and Phil Berrigan were able to make? Especially Dan, the Jesuit, and Loyola being a Jesuit university. Well, could you relate any thoughts you might have on that period of time?
Well, you know, at that point, when I was graduating from Loyola in 1973, 1974, the major moratoriums had preceded my arrival at Loyola. The sense of shutting things down, I think, was still in people's awareness, but I think there was a sense of, okay, now we have to sort of try to move back toward normalcy. I think that probably the administration at Loyola was was looking for that a lot more than they were looking for Dan Berrigan's influence. And so I myself did not encounter radicalism anywhere near what I encountered after I began to connect with the Catholic workers.
So Kent State, for example, when Kent State took place, were you in college?
No, I was still in high school at that point. And again, I don't want to excuse myself. I think it's inexcusable that I didn't find the backbone and the nerve to seek out the people who would be undertaking radical action. But I was in graduate school when I finally did that.
For almost everybody, it's it's an evolutionary process. And that's what we're trying to get to here, to try to find out what it was that got two-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee Kathy Kelly to change from this nice little Irish-American girl who goes to high school and college, and all of a sudden becomes one of the major resistors in the United States. So, if you can continue with that story as to, what brought you to some of your first serious activities, we would appreciate hearing that.
Well, I did have an opportunity to, in a sense, claim a few extra years to grow up, I think. I didn't move into a job or a tenured profession. I was a high school teacher, but I had a lot of choice making that I could engage in terms of what I was going to do with my life. I also became extremely concerned for my father. I loved my dad deeply, with many good reasons. And Dad succumbed to a debilitating experience of depression. I think life had, dealt him one of those very unfair cards. He did nothing to earn it. He was a good father, but he became so clinically depressed that he really couldn't function. He was nearly catatonic. So that did limit me a little bit. I had plans to join the Jesuit Volunteer Corps, but those plans were called off. It would have been no time to leave my mother and family. So I had a tremendous preoccupation with unjust suffering, but it was really guided and molded by my father's suffering and what could alleviate it. And how was one to understand why a good person would be hit so hard? But I do think that that experience opened up a window of empathy for me that I might not otherwise have had. And I think I longed so much to ease my father's pain and despair that there was a huge sense of relief when I could go to the soup kitchen and plonk down a plate of beans and rice in front of somebody who maybe hadn't heard a good word all day and brighten that person's day. So I do see some connectedness there. My dad lived the last 8 years of his life with me and friends of mine who were radical activists in the small apartment that we shared on the north side of Chicago. And I think those 8 years were good years of his life. But there was a time when anxiety for and concern for my father sort of almost was a transference operation when I would be able to make friends with people at the soup kitchen and the shelter.
Now, around that time, were you teaching high school after you came out of college? How does that fit in? You taught at a Jesuit high school in Chicago, I believe.
I did. At first, I taught in two schools that were all-girls schools. I sometimes joke and say that when I did go to maximum security prison, I had a little preparation because of having taught in all-girls Catholic high schools. Yeah. But those were challenging years. I mean, I needed to try to understand myself what could I believe in passionately enough that I could teach it to young people. And so I'm very grateful to all of those students who kind of, I'm sure, exercised patience putting up with me as a new young teacher. But I found my way and I found my own equilibrium. And I thoroughly enjoyed teaching in the Jesuit school when I moved to that. And by that time, I had begun to engage in civil disobedience. I had a great interest in the ending of United States wars in Central America. I was part of groups of people who were deeply distressed by the assassination of Archbishop Romero, by the rape and burial in shallow graves of four United States church women, the killing of six Jesuit priests. I suppose at that time, I and my friends, my then husband, Carl Meyer, we all of us committed ourselves in one way or another to embracing cultural changes that made it more and more possible for us to resist U.S. intervention in Central America. Just about everybody I knew had a crash room in their home so that if somebody from Central America was fleeing repression and death squads and possible torture, then they could quietly move into our homes. People, if they had time available, time off from their jobs, very often went down to El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua to study Spanish. We regularly engaged in civil disobedience. And a wonderful Mary Knoll priest at the time, Roy Bourgeois, moved into our uptown neighborhood. And what a difference that made. Roy himself had lived and worked amongst some of the poorest of the poor in Bolivia. He was very close to Mary Knoll missioners in Central America. And so Roy's charisma and his stories deeply affected us. He moved into the Catholic Worker House, and he was part of all of these activities I've talked about before. And his magnetism made a great difference. We also had many very good innovators who would design projects that would sometimes go on for months, and we would all pull in on these projects and think nothing of spending a fair amount of time either preparing for court or going to court after we'd been arrested multiple times.
What were some of the things that you did that would, you know, lead you to have to go to court? Was it sit-ins or what were some of the actions?
Oh, we had so many actions. One time we took enlarged photographs of people who had been killed in Central America, and we affixed them to Strip-Tac Plus adhesive, and we covered Chicago's federal building windows, big, huge glass windows. And as soon as we were arrested and let go, we'd go right back out and do it again. We, at one point, had filled the plaza in the federal building with vases, with the crosses that designated the names of people who'd been killed in Central America. We held sit-ins. We held marches. We went into judges' chambers, and we refused to sit down until they would hear our motions regarding the ways in which the United States was violating international law in the bombing of the port of Corinto. We eventually began to engage in actions at the Army School of the Americas. I remember being part of a fast in water only for we went, some of us, 28 days. Others carried it on, including Roy Bourgeois, Charlie Litke, for 36 days. And then after that fast, some other people did a very brave action in which they climbed the trees, the tall pine trees in Fort Benning, Georgia, and blasted with a ghetto blaster the words of Archbishop Romero almost immediately before he was killed. In the name of God, in the name of your suffering, brothers and sisters, I beg you, I order you, stop the repression, stop the killing. And that went out through the night.
For listeners that aren't familiar with the School of the Americas, you're talking about the base that the United States Army was training Latinos in methods of assassination and interrogation, etc. Right? Isn't this where the pine trees overlooking part of that school?
That's true. And it's a very dramatic place in that regard, because the soldiers come from countries where they are very often with almost no options in terms of education and jobs. And then they're treated pretty well by the Army School of the Americas. They're taken to places like Disneyland. They're promised a better future, but they're also trained in tactics that are so menacing, so frightening for people in their home countries. And it's also a base that has trained the U.S. military police to go to places like Abu Ghraib in Iraq. The soldiers who were on duty at Abu Ghraib, where there was a terrible abuse of people's basic human rights. It was a prison following the 2003 shock and awe bombing. Many of those soldiers were trained at Fort Benning.
You know, we're going to get to that too in a minute or two, but if we could back up just a minute too, there's a space of time during the 1980s where you explain about your activities dealing with Nicaragua, El Salvador, Archbishop Romero's assassination, and later on, I believe it was 1987, 88, that the Jesuits were executed. But wasn't there a time there too where you were into sort of an anti-nuke actions? Am I correct on that or no?
Well, we were in Chicago very aware of an extremely low-frequency facility in the northern woods of Wisconsin. And this was a place which could only be used in the event of a first strike. And it was called ELF. And so many of our friends that we were connected to through various Catholic worker houses would go up to the ELF facility and engage in civil disobedience. And we did too. We organized a walk from Chicago up to the ELF facility, had quite a few court cases in that area. And then eventually we were also appalled at the sentencing that was being given to people who did actions in the Midwest, in Whiteman Air Force Base, where the intercontinental ballistic missiles were buried under the ground. There were 150 of them surrounding Kansas City. There were 1,000 of them in the Midwest. And these intercontinental ballistic missiles were aimed at the Soviet Union. The Soviets had missiles aimed right back at the heartland of the United States. And it became increasingly believable that either by accident, miscalculation, or, you know, a crazed decision deliberately, one of these missiles could fly and it could bring about the extinction of the entire human race and every species on the planet. So we began to feel more and more responsible, particularly when grandparents, Jean and Joe Gump, were sentenced to years and years in prison. Jean Gump was sentenced to 8 years because she went to one of those underground missile silo sites and with others crossed into the facility, and this was trespass, according to the government, and she poured a baby bottle filled with her own blood at the site, and then with others took sledgehammers and damaged the tracks. By tracks, I'm thinking about the big cement lid that covered the underground weapon. Were it to move, it would move on a very short track. And so they did damage to that track. She was sentenced to 8 years in prison. This was a woman who had been a leader in the open housing effort that I had mentioned earlier. She was a pillar of her parish. She was a mother of 12. She was an energetic, interesting, fun, dynamic person. And there she was, sentenced to jail for 8 years in federal prison.
Yeah, and there seems to be almost some grim humor in the charges that they were violent people. They were doing violent things by trying to expose the unbelievable violence of those nuclear missiles. This is direct action, and I'm sure you've been asked before, isn't this sort of thing, many people would say, isn't there some other way to bring attention to what is going on than to damaging property? What are your thoughts on that, Kathy?
Well, I think that every way that people undertake to oppose and to nonviolently resist weapon systems is important. I would never eschew the meaningfulness of the Sane Freeze movement, of the people who tried legislative means, of the people who did teach-ins and many, many efforts at education. But I would say that, you know, here we are with the nuclear armed powers still aiming their weapons, refusing to have anything to do with the prohibition to ban nuclear weapons. And so there is room, I believe, for nonviolent civil disobedience. And the plowshares actions have a certain integrity to them, I think. There are now over 100 that have happened all around the world.
Would you just quickly explain plowshares, Kathy, to people who may not be familiar with it?
People who engage in plowshares actions take very seriously lines from the book of Isaiah, and it's also echoed in the book of Micah. When shall come the day, O Lord, when they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks? Prune fruit. Plow the land. Don't make weapons, basically. And then it goes on to say, nation shall not lift the sword against nation, neither shall they continue to learn the ways of war any longer. Well, the plowshares activists, very much led by the Barrican brothers following the end of the Vietnam War, pour their own blood over the weapons to say, look, these weapons aren't sanitized scientific projects. These are weapons that have already, when used, caused the incineration of 150,000 people in Hiroshima. These are weapons that always rob people of the resources that are needed to feed a hungry world, to eradicate disease, to help us survive our own foibles and consequences of war. The buildup of these weapons is sinful and wrongful, and so they take sledgehammers and other tools and literally damage as best they can whatever.
Kathy Kelly, you've got to tell us something about some of the direct actions that you yourself may have been involved in as a young woman who began to realize that nuclear war was a very strong possibility. What did you do as you build creative acts of direct nonviolent acts? What is on your mind right now about some of the more important events that you may have participated in?
Well, I suppose the most important for me when I was a young teacher in the Jesuit college prep school was going to the treasurer of the school and saying, look, I'd like to lower my salary beneath the taxable income become a war tax refuser. And he was a bit surprised. He said, well, you know, what about the IRA? And I thought he meant the Irish Republican Army.
Yeah.
He was thinking about a financial document. I said, no, I'm not going to support any warring group. And so that has stood me in good stead for the rest of my life. That was in, I think, 1982. And I haven't paid federal income tax since that time.
That's really an important decision that you made. Didn't the federal government get on your case about that?
Well, I didn't file in all of those years. So it was quite some time before they finally tried to garnish my wages in the 1996 or so. And at that point, I found out that they were going to try to garnish my wages, so I immediately quit my job. I was teaching at a community college at that point, and I said, look, I'm going to go off salary and finish out the year as a volunteer. How about that? And so I was grateful the administrators said okay. So that's one action of civil disobedience that's been important, but you know, quite honestly, I would forget that I was even doing it. And I needed to be part of something more dramatic. You know, there were Gene and Joe Gump in prison for these long sentences. I was a major support person when Joe Gump did his action. And so we weren't quite ready to do a plowshares action. Filled with respect for the plowshares movement, a number of us who had met, we were from Milwaukee and Chicago and Madison, Wisconsin and Kansas City, Missouri, we decided to try something a bit different that we hoped would reach the farmers in Missouri and the people living in Kansas City. We decided to do what the farmers do. We would plant corn on top of the nuclear missile silo sites. And we called it Missouri Peace Planting. And I know it might sound eccentric and quirky, but we, you know, climbed fences, we knelt down in the grasses after we planted our corn and awaited a rest. And it was, in my memory, one of the most life-giving communities I've ever been part of. It took a long time for all of us to end up going before the courts and being sentenced. I was sentenced to 1 year in maximum security prison. Others who awaited a jury trial got much stiffer sentences, including a 2.5 year sentence for several of the other defendants. But by the time we had all finished serving the time in prison, I think we knew that this was one of the most gifted times in our lives.
When was that? What year was that?
Well, that was 1988, and I think I was in prison then in late 88, most of 89.
Wow.
And another thing that happened after that year in maximum security for me was that I emerged, I don't quite know how to put this, but with a little bit more sense of backbone. If I believed something was the right thing to do, I certainly wouldn't, as a major factor, let going to prison deter me. And I also felt like it made sense to put one's whole self forward to resist wars. And I wonder if you might remember, Jack, that Dan Berrigan had once said that one of the reasons we don't have peace is because the peacemakers only kind of give half of their lives over or take half the risk of when the soldiers have to take a greater risk than the peacemakers take. And so when the United States was making it pretty clear that there was going to be an invasion of Iraq, I started to hear from people primarily in Europe who said, we want to form a team of people who will go to the border areas between Iraq and Saudi Arabia, Iraq and Kuwait, inside of Iraq, and say, you know, don't send armed soldiers, send us, and try to form an interposition team, a group of people who would interpose themselves between the warring parties. And I wanted to join that and applied, and this was 1990. We knew the war was coming. You could tell because of the media buildup. And I didn't hear anything. And then right before that 1991 war started, I had gotten word that if I could be in Boston with my passport and with a few vaccines under my belt, I could go over to Iraq and join this team. So that was, for me, a new awakening in my life. It was my first experience being part of an international peace team effort that attempted to interpose people between warring parties, and I learned a great deal.
Kathy Kelly, you've got to tell us a bit more about this. This is fascinating. So you went to Iraq, and the war was about ready to begin.
Well, that's true. And by the time the war began, we were 88 people from 18 different countries, and we had managed to sort ourselves out into affinity groups. That was very, very important because otherwise we, you know, with all of our different languages and practices and some differences in beliefs, we were having a hard time organizing ourselves, but sorted out into affinity groups with representation. We created a pretty democratic camp group, and you know, we'd figured out how to dig latrines and sort out the food and make sure we had water. And then one night the warplanes started to fly overhead, and we all crawled out of our tents, took blankets. It was quite cold in the desert by then, and we huddled underneath the desert skies, and you could hear dogs barking, and the dogs had never heard the sounds of warplanes before out there in that desert plain. And they barked and barked until, Jack, I don't know, they might have barked themselves hoarse, they might have barked themselves to death. And I always thought that was a fitting symbol of the onslaught of that war in 1991. It was called Desert Storm.
And so where were you when Desert Storm took place?
Well, the Kuwaitis had not allowed us to go near the Kuwait Iraq border. The Saudis didn't want us at the Saudi-Iraq border. So the Iraqis said, yes, this is a good idea. This was Saddam Hussein's regime. And they said, you can go to a place called Judayat Arar. And it was a place where people on the Hajj would encamp before they crossed into Saudi Arabia. So it was definitely on the Iraq side of the Iraq-Saudi border. And we stayed there until the middle of the war, when Iraqi authorities thought maybe the United States military would engage in a pincer movement. This would mean that some of the U.S. military by land would come deep into the Iraqi territory and try to sort of cut off any Iraqi troops that were making a move to go along those roads. And so we could have been in the way. It was plausible, but the Iraqis didn't want to stick around to find out. And so they came to us and said, we're going to evacuate you to Baghdad. And we said, no, we can't do this. We came with a mission to interpose ourselves between the warring parties. And if the U.S. military comes along, we can't say, get us out of here. But the Iraqis, understandably, were saying, well, we don't want to stay with you. So it was a very hard moment for our group. We'd found our equilibrium. We really were ready to stay. But the options were narrow. We could have said, okay, we're going to start walking toward the Saudi border. But we really didn't have any sense of where landmines might have been planted. We didn't really have a sufficient amount of water to trek through the desert. We didn't really have a very good compass of direction. And so eventually, even though we had formed a circle to say we choose to stay, eventually everybody was loaded onto a bus and we were evacuated to Baghdad. And there the bombing was fierce. We were inside of a place with a bomb shelter. And I remember being in that bomb shelter and seeing mothers cradling their infants, looking at their husbands, wanting assurance, the building's not going to fall down on top of us, this is going to end. And, you could see the fathers were pretty rattled too, and nobody could say what was going to happen next. And of course, Jack, nobody could have known that Iraq would then be subjected, after that horrible bombing that wiped out every electrical facility in the country, that Iraq would be subjected to 13 years of economic sanctions.
You were in Baghdad, you were there for two wars, but we're now talking about the so-called Persian Gulf War. And to let us know the chronology of this, we're talking about 1991, isn't that right?
That's right. That was called Operation Desert Storm. And back in the United States, people were going to the bars and filling up the bars and raising beers and shouting, Rock Iraq, slam Saddam, say hello to Allah. And they had no idea, No idea, because of a kind of cartoonized version of foreign policy, no idea the suffering that was already being put in place, because absent the electrical facilities and with no equipment being allowed in, the sewage and sanitation systems all across Iraq were becoming very badly compromised. And this led to the spread of disease, gastrointestinal diseases, diarrhea, hunger, respiratory disease. And there were no medicines, no antibiotics, no children's vitamins even. And so first the children were dying in the hundreds, and then the thousands, and then the hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, and tell us about what the Secretary of State would later on say about the estimated 500,000 who died, according to the World Health Organization. You remember that interview in 60 Minutes, right?
Right. Leslie Stahl, in May of 1996, had gone to Iraq, and she was appalled. When you went into those hospitals, it was horrible. It was like a death row for infants. And Leslie said to Madeleine Albright, I'm swatting flies from the faces of these children. There's no electricity. There's no air conditioning. These are ungodly, places. And she asked Leslie Stahl did, I mean, Leslie Stahl asked Madeleine Albright, who then was the Secretary of State, do you think it's worth it? Are these policies worth it? And Madeleine Albright replied, yes, Leslie, I'm a humanitarian person, and it's a difficult choice to make, but the price, we think the price is worth it. Well, this reverberated around the Arab world, around the Muslim world. People felt slapped. How could a U.S. leader say that the deaths of hundreds of thousands of children was an acceptable price to pay for policies that weren't at all changing Saddam Hussein's regime? Policies that were directly affecting the elderly, the sick, the poor, and hundreds of thousands of children.
So, Kathy, you stayed there for some time. I know you were back and forth, but you spent a lot of time there in the post-Gulf War period in observing and working. Could you just elaborate a bit more on that very important part of your life?
Well, this again, Jack, was a time in my life when I was involved in something that was too little and too late. But by 1995, we realized that two elderly sisters, Eileen Story and Anne Montgomery, little tiny nuns, but very vibrant, vital people, would beg us. They'd come back from having visited the religious orders that they were connected to in Iraq, and they would say to us, you know, somebody's got to do something. Well, by that time, I'm taking care of my elderly father. I'm very much involved in a number of different kinds of disarmament efforts. We were increasingly aware of the Palestinian suffering under Israeli oppression. And I honestly thought, well, you know, what can we do? And we finally, at Christmas time, got together in 1995, about 12 of us. And we agreed we wouldn't leave my kitchen table until we had come up with some kind of a plan to oppose the economic sanctions. And then it got really easy, actually, because we realized we couldn't become a humanitarian relief group. You know, we couldn't afford more than, you know, a few things of aspirin. But what we did know how to do was engage in nonviolent civil resistance.
You've been listening to episode 2 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm Jack Gilroy, and I've been speaking with well-known peace activist Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Be sure to listen to episode 3 of Nonviolent Direct Action, which is part 2 of this conversation. You can subscribe to Nonviolent Direct Action on iTunes.